enough the Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
It's the Peter B. Collins Show, supported by listeners, and I'm grateful for your financial support. Natalie Reel of Montana is one of our staunchest supporters. And if you visit our new website, click on that button that says You Can Help. And we now have subscription options. You can choose $5 a month, $10 a month, $20 a month, whatever works for you. And I really appreciate you helping us kick off this new podcast series of the Peter B. Collins Show. Today's program, we're going to focus primarily on health care. It's really health insurance reform. Not much more than that. Unless we manage to put forth a breakthrough. Tim Carpenter, the fastest talking, hardest working progressive and national director of Progressive Democrats of America, will join us in a moment. And then Jeff Cohen, who serves on the board of PDAmerica.org. He's going to be joining us. We're going to talk a little bit about the media firestorm and the way the media is playing, the corporate astroturf messages that are being pushed out there. I call it demagoguery. But I was watching CNN, and gosh, they can't find words like that. And also on today's program, we're going to meet Dr. Eugene Uphoff. He's a medical doctor in Portland, Oregon. And he describes himself as a mad-as-hell doctor. To find out more, go to madasheldoctors.com. They're kicking off a road trip from Portland to Washington, D.C. right after Labor Day. And you can help join that caravan and build the movement for real health care reform and a single-payer approach in this country. Tim Carpenter returns to our program, as I mentioned, a very hard-working guy who pushes a lot of the important issues that I care about. And I last saw Tim in person at the Democratic Convention in Denver last year when the PD America team put on their own mini-convention with a lot of great speakers, and single-payer was at the top of the agenda then. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Peter, thanks so much. It's great to find you over here. Thanks again for the opportunity. What a lineup. I'm honored to be on with everybody.
Well, there's a lot to talk about here, and our viewpoint is being lost because of this you know, astroturf effort from the corporate interests that are using some unhinged right-wingers to break up these town hall meetings. And it's also being lost in the corporate compromises that are occurring in the Democratic Party. And so as progressives, we have a lot of work to do. Now, let's start with something good, and that is that just before the House broke for its August recess, Speaker Pelosi appeared to respond to the pressure from people like us, and she acknowledged that she will permit the Conyers single-payer bill, H.R. 676, to come to the floor for a vote. Now, on the surface, this seems like a victory, but I was talking to Lynn Woolsey, my congresswoman and a member of the Progressive Caucus, and she was concerned that this is a bit of a trick to split progressive interests and to essentially force them to choose between a long-shot single-payer plan, long-shot in terms of passage, not in terms of practicality, or this watered-down, fuzzy public option that Democrats have been talking about. How do you size it up, Tim?
Well, it's a very complicated question, Peter, and I want to just stress the importance for programs like this to give us the opportunity to really kind of talk through it. Lynn is a friend, an ally, co-chair of the Progressive Caucus, was with us in Denver, as you know, and we've been looking to her and Congressman Raul Grijalva, the other co-chair of the Progressive Caucus, to really push the single-payer vote. We think it's very important that the members of Congress at least vote on whether or not we can move forward with a single-payer plan at the national level. And as you know, in Denver, Congressman Conyers was with us. Strategically, we have a big question. There are those in our movement that think the vote will be a weak vote And by doing that, it will hurt us to bring single-payer back up again. So that's certainly one argument. There's another very strong argument that this is a real litmus test. For those of us working at the grassroots level, we really want to know where members of Congress are. So come the elections of 2010, we have a real marker on which to hold them accountable. So there's one whole question within our own movement, should we have the vote? And as Lynn indicated, the concern from the caucus is that it's an either-or. We would hope, and we are arguing very strongly with the members of Congress we're meeting right now this August, that we get the vote, the substitute amendment. It's important that people understand this is not a standalone vote on single-payer 676. Congressman Wiener was given the opportunity through the committee work with the chair, Henry Waxman, to allow a substitute amendment which would put the language of 676 into H.R. 32000, the bill that Lynn's talking about. Mm-hmm. So we want a strong vote there. Now, realistically, Peter, we've been at this long enough. A really good vote, if we could get 150 votes, that would be great. Let's hope we get there. Then the question becomes, when we lose that, then we come back to Lynn's question on the watered-down public option. And that's a whole other discussion we need to have. But in addition to that vote on Wiener, there's another important amendment that I hope we can spend a little bit of time on today as well. If, in fact, we lose at the national level, which many of us in the movement are realistic and understand that we're not going to get single-payer this year, as hard as we're fighting, we know in our protracted real struggle, just as they were in Canada, but we can hopefully open up a front to move this battle onto the states. And that's the other important amendment today we can spend a little time on. While we were getting Waxman to allow us to vote on the Wiener Amendment in his committee, while Congressman George Miller, the chair of his committee, voted against it, Congressman Kucinich, Dennis Kucinich from Ohio, mm-hmm. our good friend, was successful in getting an amendment that would allow the states to move forward with their own single-payer option.
Right.
So there's a lot we need to talk about.
And,
now,
and there's
one bill, again, we need to understand, and the listeners need to understand right now, the House is looking at three separate bills. So we don't even know what we're going to have post-Labor Day when it comes to the House. Hopefully we pass the Wiener Amendment. If we lose that, hopefully we get the Kucinich Amendment. It doesn't get stripped out. Then hopefully we get that out of the House on whatever the bill looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Then we got to go to the Senate side, where we only had four senators, led by our good friend again, Bernie Sanders, on 703, which again is the state option amendment to allow the states to move forward. So got to get it through the Senate, got to get it through the House, then we got to get it through the conference committee. So there's a lot going on, and I know we'll talk about it more, and Lynn's correct. We need to stay focused on the prize. For all of us within Progressive Democrats of America, the California Nurses Association, the doctors that are fighting for single-payer and health care now, we have not given up the fight. We still see a light to single-payer. It may not come in one vote here in Congress at the national level, but we will continue to fight state by state, just as they did in Canada, beginning in Saskatchewan when it was province by province. We still believe that fight is a worthy fight. The frustration, and we can talk more about that later as we move forward, and certainly with Jeff and your other guests, is to see our progressive friends and even our progressive allies within the Progressive Caucus who have given up that fight.
Mm-hmm.
And organizations, and I don't want to name names, but Move On, DFA, and all of our friends that have really peeled off and given up on the fight on single payer. And we remain just as committed today as we were when we saw you in Denver, and just as committed as we were 5 years ago when we launched Progressive Democrats of America, when John Conyers was the first one to speak on single payer. This is the real cutting issue, and we have to stay true to that.
Now, Tim, let me start with an idealistic thought.
Because this far, I'm ready, Peter.
Given all of the noise that is out there right now, I see a moment, and I'm pessimistic that Obama will seize it in this manner. But if we can continue, and I just want to take a moment here to applaud the work of Rachel Maddow, because on her nightly show on MSNBC, she has been doing incredible work of exposing who is paying for these AstroTurf efforts.
Absolutely.
And tracing the money back to law firms and conservative PR firms and the corporate money that fuels them. And, I see this opportunity here for a game changer. And again, I'm pessimistic that it will occur, but I still see the potential. And that is if President Obama could make a major case about how the corrupt interests here are trying to preserve their obscene profits. And if we can turn this demagoguery about death panels into a discussion of the death squads that populate insurance companies today, because they're the ones who are denying care. And these bozos who are, interrupting town hall meetings to try to obstruct this whole process are either ignorant or, willful tools of those who have been scoring these egregious profits as our healthcare premiums and direct costs have escalated over the last 15 to 20 years. And so before I give up on that, do you see an opportunity here to turn the tables and to really push back on the demagogues and say, wait a minute, nobody is going to pull the plug on grandma or grandpa. That's not in the language of any of these bills. But if you keep this up, we're going to pull the plug on the for-profit insurance companies.
Well, we would certainly hope so. And as you know, Peter, when we began this struggle 5 years ago and when we were in Denver, our goal was to move, at that time, presidential nominee Barack Obama, now our candidate, who was elected. And if you remember at that time, Barack Obama said if he had to start over, he would be for single-payer. When he was in the legislature in Illinois, he was for single-payer. Now in the town hall meetings just in New Hampshire, he's denying he was even there. If you remember, we started this debate, we were talking about health care reform. Now we're talking about health insurance reform. The whole the definition of what we began with and where we are today, the whole thing has been turned upside down. And I agree with you. And when the window potters of the world, these are people that were executives in the insurance company, are coming forward, that used to work in the industry itself and are exposing what went on in the industry. And when the public is finally beginning to understand that $1.4 million every day, in addition to all the money that's being spent on the AstroTurf, is blocking them from getting the truth, I do remain hopeful. Peter, and I base that hope on based on what's happening at the grassroots level away from these town hall meetings. Progressive Democrats of America and many of the grassroots activists that are committed to this struggle have lobbied in Washington, have got major rallies in Washington, as you know, and we've come back home. And while the theater is at the town hall meetings, there's some really important work going on inside those congressional offices right now, and it's important that people go and meet with their member of Congress or at least with their legislative aide that works on health care issues. What we're finding in PDA, when we have a civil dialogue, an intellectual exchange on the merits of single-payer versus this quote-unquote public option, that we're moving members of Congress. I just met with my own Congress member 2 days ago, Congressman John Oliver, out here in Western Mass, the place that launched Rachel Maddow, if I say so myself.
Yes.
He committed himself and understands why the Wiener Amendment is important, why the Kucinich Amendment is important. So we will continue to grind through. I do think we're at a sea change, and I think when you hear from Jeff later today to talk about what is happening in the corporate media, for the first time, whatever channel you turn to now, while it may be not the debate we want, single payer is certainly at the top of the agenda right now. And everywhere you go, from the lunch counter to the classroom, people are talking about single payer, talking about health care, and talking about meaningful reform. So the key will be, as you said, in the coming weeks, if we can turn it to people to understand until we can get the insurance companies out of this. They, more than anybody, are regulating who gets insurance and who doesn't get insurance. And the economics of it, the bankruptcy that's causing every American to lose members of their family, over 50% of the people currently filing for bankruptcy come out of this mess. If those facts and figures are brought forward as we dismiss this unbelievable, just bogus, unbelievable traction that some of this stuff is getting, I do agree with you. I hope. And we continue to organize and mobilize in the belief that we can turn it, Peter. And we have certainly turned up the volume, and the majority of Americans are engaged in the debate, some for the wrong reasons, but many for the right reasons.
Yeah. Now, Tim, what is your current understanding of what the public option would be? How is it defined, and what limited group of people would it be offered to?
Well, there's, again, it's very difficult in this little bit of time we have, so I encourage folks to go and look and understand that there are three different bills. There's three committees of jurisdiction. The Ways and Means Committee under Rangel, and then Miller and Waxman, and their committees are forwarding three different bills. The public option, the short version of whatever the public option is to emerge, the thing that we need to stay focused on as single-payer advocates is that the public option is not single-payer. Until we get a true single-payer, and what we mean by true single-payer, it's important to understand, until we drive the insurance companies out, we're never going to be able to get to the 47 million Americans that need health insurance, or the 22,000 have lost their lives because they can't afford health insurance. We've got to get the insurance companies out. Why? The $400 billion that's being spent currently in the systems that we have right now and the money that will still be spent in a public option because the insurance companies will be engaged, that money will not be put to helping people to get real health care. We have to move from a discussion of health insurance to health care. This should be a debate about health care. Health care should be a human right. Everybody in, nobody out. That's what we continue to advocate for. Mm-hmm. The public option currently, basically the rough sketches of what we're seeing, if the Congress were to move forward with even the most robust public option that's being discussed. And let's remember that our good friend Rahm Emanuel at the White House forced Waxman to cut a deal with the Blue Dogs and couldn't even get all seven of the Blue Dogs on the committee to go for it. But even the most robust public option will only cover those 10 million of the 47 million we're talking about. And we know that number, 47 million, is higher. The number that we're basing it on is from a number of years back, plus the Americans that have lost their insurance through losing their jobs. So the public option currently, even within the debate within the Congressional Progressive Caucus, at the most robust will only cover $10 million of that $47 million we want to get covered. Mm-hmm. It will not have the global pricing that we need so desperately. It will not break the stranglehold that the pharmaceutical industry has on us. Again, as we began this discussion, $1.4 million from the pharmaceutical industries and from the medical professionals that are blocking this effort. So the public option is not an option for us that are advocating for single payer. We remain committed to single payer until we get the insurance companies out, until we have a single payer program like every other industrial nation, can we really deliver the health care that we so desperately need in this country. So we, like you, Peter, will keep watching. There's three bills. The public option fluctuates between covering at most $10 million and as little as $3 million, depending upon how you look at this. So until the three bills are consolidated, we really know what we're talking about. That's what's so difficult about this debate,
yeah. And
why we continue to turn it back on its ear and say, we don't want to engage in a public option debate. That's why even our good friend Lynn Woolsey, who's on our own board, when she comes back to us and says, can you support the public option? It's premature to support the public option.
Right.
It was premature when DFA and Howard Dean supported the public option. It was premature when MoveOn put all of its financial resources into a public option before we even had a debate on single payer.
Well, and so, this is a really important point, because the Democrats are negotiating with themselves.
Absolutely.
They, you know, Obama still holds some hope for some Republican votes on this, and that's a crock. You know, by the way, we're not on radio, so we can say bullshit even, okay?
We've come a long way.
Yeah. So, Tim, it infuriates me, because all of this effort, all of the political capital expended, all of the corporate money that's being splashed around and doesn't really create jobs or do anything good, you know, what are we going to get for it? In a best case, we're going to get a removal of the pre-existing conditions bans and a shuffle of who gets to cover what groups of people. But, you know, we're not going to do anything to rein in the escalating costs, and we're not seeing anything that really would expand the coverage to the 90 or 95% that the talking points tell us.
Well, I mean, you nailed it right there, Peter. It's important to stay focused. Cost control and coverage. Single payer is the only plan that can do that. There's no cost control containments when you allow the insurance companies to ride roughshod over our health industry. So that's the key for us. But the things that give me hope right now, the debate within the Democratic Party and for progressive Democrats, if you remember when we met a year ago, we were working for candidates like Donna Edwards and Eric Massa, who were elected. And these are the shining examples today that I want to give people, because it's difficult day in and day out to find those little victories. And what happened 2 years ago, where there were two members of Congress that ran against all odds, committed to single payer and to end the occupation of Iraq and not to escalate in Afghanistan. That's why PDA, we call our campaign Healthcare, Not Warfare. Every day we make a decision on how we spend our money. So here's two freshman members of Congress recently elected who were immediate co-sponsors of 676, as we said, Representative John Conyers' single-payer bill, have never wavered in that debate, remain committed to single-payer as we speak today, have pushed the senior members of their own party to support single-payer, and have voted against each appropriation and authorization on the military side of Afghanistan and Iraq since they went to Congress.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a shining example of what can be. So as this debate moves forward, and as you said, in reality, whatever does pass, the only hope really we believe for a lot of us in the single-payer struggle is if the Kucinich Amendment struggles survive and we get that amendment through, then we have a pathway to take this fight right out to your home state in California. As you know, California has twice passed a single-payer bill. Sheila Kuehl did it twice,
mm-hmm.
and unfortunately Schwarzenegger vetoed it. Now his day is over. We're going to elect a real Democrat now, hopefully in California, that can sign single-payer. So let's focus there. Let's fight as hard as we can through September, get the best possible bill we can, but get an amendment that allows us to move forward and allows us to move a plan forward in California, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Arizona, Massachusetts, and demonstrate single-payer. And as we've always said, whenever we get on the call together, Peter, take this to the communities and elect Democrats like Eric Mass and Don Edwards next time, and let's go back to Washington as a stronger, more focused movement and really push a single-payer plan that will ultimately win. And as you know, Peter, we're in a long struggle. It's not going to happen this session. It's not going to happen the next session. But we've got to stay focused on what it is we're about and elect those members of Congress that will stand for it. And Don Edwards and Eric Massa are really the benchmark of the members of Congress we need to elect. And to have freshmen like those standing up to Pelosi and Hoyer at this hour, at this time, this summer, and still pushing single payer, we do have some things to celebrate.
And, Tim, what seems most promising to me is that Kucinich and Sanders bills are pretty similar. And if they were passed in each House, they could possibly survive the inevitable conference committee. And that does seem to be the best route to keeping single-payer alive conceptually and to permit it, as you say, to be worked through at the state level. I am, optimistic the California voters would embrace it. The problem is that Schwarzenegger has just, ruined the fiscal health of the state of California through his bad move on the car tax when he was elected, and then his kowtowing to Grover Norquist and the no new taxes crowd, so that we're broke, and I can't imagine that we could afford to provide funding for a single-payer plan for 5 or 6 years. That said, that may be our best route forward.
No, absolutely, and we need to, we can say it here on this radio show, I think, and in all honesty, we need to talk about raising taxes. We need to talk about taxing those that are making $200,000 or more. We need to start having a system that will allow those that are benefiting from it to begin to pay back. We need to put together the infrastructure that will allow the states to have the financial resources they need to move forward. But before we do that, as you said, we have to create the political climate in which to do it. I think California is ripe for that. I think a California native myself and visiting quite often, it's unbelievable what's going on in the state, and there is a way out. And I do, if we frame this, and the California nurses, who you know very closely, who are organizing in California, understand single-payer needs to be viewed as an economic stimulus. We need to turn the whole question about the financial drain of single-payer and turn it on its ear. This is a stimulator. This can help us. And at the national level, when we hear one more conservative tell us we can't afford it, I didn't hear any of the stringent arguments that are being used against the health care reform being used when the last defense appropriations or supplemental came up.
Nope.
That's why we come back with health care, not warfare. Every day we make a decision. $223 billion already in Afghanistan. What could that money do in California? What could that money do in Pennsylvania if it was proportionally distributed around the country to allow those states to move forward with a single-payer plan? Those are the kind of debates we need to have and frame this whole discussion and turn it on its ear. And the California nurses, as you know, right there in California, are the strongest advocates of this. They wrote the study that showed at the national level what single-payer could do, and you'll hear lots more from them in California as we move this discussion forward.
Yeah. So, Tim, where can our activist listeners get engaged right now? What do you recommend that they do, and what message should they promote?
Well, again, Peter, thanks for the opportunity. And everybody who's listening, if you're not familiar with PDA, as we began this discussion, visit the website, pdamerica.org. Get signed up if you're not already. We can give you the resources, the talking points that allow you to move forward with confidence on this debate. It's very fluid. As we began this discussion today, there's a lot going on. So we need to educate ourselves. How do we do that? Visit the website. There's all kinds of links you'll find on the website. We have an entire page devoted to the single-payer issue. It's under our issue organizing teams. You can download that information. There's all kinds of click and send emails you can get out to your Congress member. If you're moved today, sign up on the website. Contact your member of Congress today. Go to the town hall meetings if you're inclined to, but more importantly, call the office of your member of Congress. Make an appointment. Go with your neighbors and friends and ask them specifically, you want to vote on the Wiener Amendment, which will allow single payer to have a vote in Congress. And then we want to vote on the Kucinich Amendment, which would allow those states to move forward with single payer that want to. And you're in a great state in California to be engaged. PDA is very well organized in California. Again, if you visit the website, all the way from San Francisco to San Diego, we have chapters this weekend. We're going to be in San Luis Obispo with all the Democratic activists to chart a course inside the Democratic Party. That's where I was fortunate enough to see Peter last time, where we passed a single-payer bill in the state party and put the California Democratic Party on record. So there's a majority of Americans that want to do this and a majority of Democrats that want to move in this direction. So the most important thing, if you're moved today, hopefully we raise some questions, engage yourself. You can do that very easily by simply getting signed up on the website, but more importantly, turn off your TV, turn off your computer, and go to your member of Congress office, hold them accountable, and get engaged. Join a chapter of PDA or a like-minded organization in your neighborhood. The only way we can turn it around.
Well, Tim, I really appreciate your advocacy on this, and you're a fascinating combination of immediate action with a long-term vision. And often, people can't accommodate both of those in one human brain. So I really respect you for that and appreciate the energy you put into all this.
Well, Peter, again, thanks so much for the opportunity. And we're very proud of the shoulders we stand on PDA. There is a roadmap. We've been engaged in it going back from Reverend Jackson when he ran for president, Tom Hayden there in California, all the way back to Henry Wallace. And if we take it all the way back from Thomas Paine, there's been a lot of great people that work in the media and project and some great visionaries, and we're proud to be part of that movement. And thanks for the opportunity.
And Tim, I just want to close by saying that I hope you've seen that new movie, In the Loop.
Oh, you bet. Mimi Kennedy stole the show.
Yeah, it was so neat to see her in that role. And for people who don't know, Mimi is an actress in Hollywood who's been very active, one of the co-founders of PDA, right?
Absolutely. She was with us from day one and has never wavered.
And she plays the part of this State Department official who is questioning the intelligence in a rush to war. And it's an interesting piece in some ways because it's a British film. It doesn't quite, connect with the American real politics sensibility. But I think that it raises a lot of great issues, and there are a lot of funny moments in there.
Oh, it's hard to be objective with Mimi in it, but I highly, as you said, recommend it. It's one of those movies that it doesn't say Iraq, but you certainly know what they're talking about. And it's funny and sobering all at the same time, and it's a great night at the movie. So I highly recommend it. And if you get a chance, Mimi, if you see her out in the streets working on single payer, let her know you saw it. And thanks for the plug for the movie. I think it's a great one. Thank you.
All right. Tim Carpenter, visit the website, pdamerica.org. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks again.
I'm looking for your feedback. Your comments are welcome. Send me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com. Or log on to the website, peterbcollins.com, and you can add your comments in the area beneath each podcast information listing. Still to come on this program today, Dr. Eugene Uphoff from Portland. He's a mad-as-hell doctor, and he's going to tell you about the road trip they're planning starting right after Labor Day, all the way to Washington, D.C., advocating for single-payer health care coverage. Jeff Cohen returns to our program. He's a co-founder of the media watchdog group called FAIR. He is an associate professor of journalism and the director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College. And he is the author of Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media. Also is a board member of PDA. We were just talking to his colleague, Tim Carpenter. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Great to be with you.
Nice to talk with you. And first up, I want to talk about the sheer demagoguery that has been unleashed this August on Americans. And they're focusing on the town hall meetings, but it goes well beyond that. We see Charles Grassley, the senator from Iowa, who Obama says nice things about, who he's counting on to deliver one or two Republican votes for whatever package ultimately emerges. And as he traipses through Iowa, he's using the Sarah Palin talking points about death panels and how you really need to be afraid of end-of-life counseling. And it's remarkable because the immediate roots I see from the Joe the Plumber and Palin campaign comments of last year, but this is a very carefully calculated and well-funded effort to throw a spanner in the gear chain.
Yeah, I agree. I see it as a continuation of the campaign of 2008, and I think that what's happened is that the Republican Party has become largely a faith-based extremist party. Even a guy like Grassley, who, as you say, Obama has singled out as a moderate, the Republican senator from Iowa, he's echoing the talking points of the right wing that he knows not to be true. And you have this wag the dog, the tail wagging the dog phenomenon, where you know that the senators have a better idea what's in the bill, but when they go out and talk to constituents, they imitate the Glenn Becks and the Sarah Palins and the Joe the Plumbers, and they imitate their ignorance. And so the saddest thing about all this, it's not a new conclusion I've drawn, that the Republican Party has been largely taken over by religious-based right-wingers. But what's really sad is we have a president who keeps trying to cut a deal with a Republican Party that's been captured by the right wing, including the senators he wants to make a deal with, like Grassley. And, you know, it's a simple thing in geometry or math. If Obama begins his process of discussion and he's like a baby step to the left of center, or he's sort of dead center on most policy issues, And he's intent on splitting the difference with the Republican Party, which is off the right edge of the mainstream. It's on the far right wing. Then any deal made with someone who's baby step to the left of center, making a deal with the far right wing, the center of your discussion, the center of your agreement, the center of your policy compromise will be several steps to the right of center.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's been happening on bailing out Wall Street. It's what's been happening in foreign policy. It's what's happening now on health care, quote, reform, unquote.
Yeah. And what we're seeing is that rational thinking is a liability in what passes for debate about so-called health care reform. It's modest changes to health insurance as
yep.
it's shaping up. And the same fine people who concocted the term partial birth abortion
yep.
have locked in on this presumably focus-tested phrase about death panels.
Yep.
And it doesn't matter to them that it's a Republican congressman, now senator from Georgia, Johnny Isaacson, who actually wrote this piece of legislation.
And now Isaacson disavows it.
Oh, really? That's new to me.
Yeah, yeah. As of yesterday, Isaacson was, it was his idea, and because of the strength of the know-nothings and the religious extremists inside his own party, now he's saying he's not for this, or you know, that he's tired of Democrats attributing it to him.
Wow.
Again, there's no reality anymore. You know, it's all what the media figures and what the political figures say is reality. And I would argue that the unreality of the whole discussion is largely the blame of the right wing, but it does include Obama, that Obama's constantly saying things that show a disrespect for reality.
Mm-hmm.
When his every discussion begins with, look, we don't want the government to take over health care. That's not what we want. No one is talking about that. And then, you know, when you have these seniors and others at town hall meetings saying, I don't want the government taking over health care, and then you say, well, sir, you look over 65. Are you on Medicare?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, I'm on Medicare. And, you know, the unreality, I think, begins with an Obama who's always on the retreat, sort of using the right-wing talking points, but saying we're not going to the right, you know,
mm-hmm.
these are the right-wing talking points, but trust me, don't fear those right-wing talking points. You have the whole discussion being around the right-wing talking points
yes,
instead of being about reality.
The frame and the language is set by the other side.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I give Rachel Maddow in particular a lot of credit for her dogged reporting over the last couple of weeks, tracing the talking points back to the think tanks, the law firms, the unethical PR firms, some of which are sending out forged documents to try to support their phony notions. And she's done a great job with that. But the administration and most Democrats are on the defensive. And instead of saying what they are for and what is in these mysterious boxes 1, 2, and 3, including the one marked public option, you know, they spend most of their time, and this is exactly the tactic the Republicans consider a success, they've got Obama spending his capital on defusing the lies that they have inserted into the dialogue.
Well, keep in mind that we went through this 16 years ago with the Clintonites, where they proposed something that was completely ununderstandable, complex, left the big insurance companies in power, but did some tinkering around the edges of a corrupt system. They never even brought it to a vote in 1993, so-called health care reform.
Right.
They were completely on the defensive, denying what was in, you know, no, it isn't what the right wing says. We already gone through that tragedy, and now we're doing it again with Obama as farce. The interesting thing back then, after the Clintonites completely bungled health care reform because they refused to support and campaign for something that was easily understandable, because of that, as soon as it failed, President Clinton was on the talk show of Jim Hightower. And Hightower said, why didn't you just support Medicare for All? There's so much support for that in Congress. Why didn't you just get the White House behind that?
Mm-hmm.
And then Clinton, you know, in his typical fashion, says, well, we didn't think that would work, but now I regret it. You know, the reality is that what we needed in 1993 and what we need now, but especially in 1993, what we needed was for the campaign to be about, look, we're going to have health insurance reform in the sense of, instead of having these huge profiteers provide you with insurance, insurance companies don't treat anyone, don't cure anyone, don't heal anyone, we're going to have the government provide insurance to everyone, not just people over 65. That's the reform. It's that simple. And that would have come up for a vote in 1993. It would have come very close to passing. That's what the fight should be about. Are we going to just take the profiteers out of insurance,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and get the government to provide the insurance, leave the doctors and the clinics private, let you choose whoever you want under the sun, but you get your insurance through a single-payer, not-for-profit government provision, just
right,
like everyone does over the age of 65. It's so simple.
Yeah, it is.
I've been dreaming of a vote on that. I don't know that we'd win it the first time. You know,
well,
you don't usually win votes
now, Jeff,
on the first time.
Maybe you and I have some sort of dream channeling going here, because I have been, you know, as I get more and more frustrated with this bullshit that's flying and
right,
the way the Democrats have been negotiating with themselves. I hope that they would just someday wake up and say, oh, screw it.
Right.
Let's just sign a simple bill here that says Medicare for All.
Right.
And let's consign these insurance companies to the scrap heap. Let them
right,
scramble. And, you know, they can sell death insurance, and, you know, and funeral
right,
insurance and car insurance. And they can come up with other ways to make themselves relevant. But, you know, what we've seen is from the start, the corporate Democrats, and you've got to include Rahm Emanuel as a key driver,
yep,
here, the White House chief of staff, they have made sure that single payer, you know, John Conyers had to beg to be included in a meeting back in March where even though he was permitted to attend, they really didn't pay any attention to what he and the medical doctor he brought had to say.
Yep.
And that was the clear signal that this was going to be an inside play to keep the industry happy, and even still, the industry is spending huge amounts to just, you know, do anything to defeat it, and the Democrats really don't have a plan on how to counter this.
But we've gone through this nightmare in 1993, and, you know, it was the Rahm Emanuel types in 1993. The fact is, that what concerns me is groups like Democracy for America, headed by Howard Dean, you know, Jim Dean, Move On. You know, you don't make your maximum demand the place that you think Obama's going to cut the deal with the right wing. What millions of activists needed to do was demand exactly what you've just put forward, which is we have Medicare for All. It's simple. Everyone understands it. We just take the profiteering out of the provision of health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
We leave the doctors private. We leave the clinics private. You
yep,
choose. You have complete choice. Something that simple, that should have been what Move On and Democracy for America and all these groups rallied around. If they had done that, then Obama gets to look in the middle when he says, you know, we're not going to go all the way to government-provided Medicare for All, but we are going to have the strongest, best public insurance option that can compete in the marketplace. He would have been able to position himself in the center, which is where Obama always wants to be, you know, with the left wing pushing for Medicare for All, the right wing saying no change because of death panels or whatever, and Obama would have been in a strengthened position. As it is, as you've been pointing out, the corporate Democrats have led and bungled this fight, as they always do and always will, and they're on the defensive. There's no pull to their left. Obama is going to the AARP town hall meeting, and town meeting where he's answering questions from AARP, and he's going out and saying things like, look, I know the public option is controversial, but... So he's on defensive even about something as minuscule
right,
as having a public alternative, by the way, that you have to pay for. It's not Medicare. You don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to pay for it. So he's characterizing that as controversial. What we wanted, and this is the lesson that MoveOn needs to learn, and Democracy for America and all these Netroots groups, you need to make a maximum demand that will allow Obama to cut a deal somewhere in the middle. You don't want Obama taking a demand that you and the Netroots have sent out millions of emails, we need a public option, and then have Obama go there and say, look, at the ARP, I know this is controversial, this public option, but what you want Obama to say is, look, I know it's controversial to go to completely public, not-for-profit health insurance for all, Medicare for all.
Mm-hmm.
I know that's controversial, but damn it, we're going to have at least a strong public option, a public plan that competes with private insurance that will be as good as the Cadillac of any private insurance plan. That's what you wanted Obama to say. And so I'm telling you that I fault a lot Netroots groups for not having the foresight to understand that activists have to make maximum demands. Corporate liberals will cut a deal somewhere in the middle. But if you join the corporate liberals in very minuscule reforms from the get-go, then when they cut the deal halfway between themselves and the right wing, it'll be end up being four steps to the right of center.
You wrote a powerful commentary that's still up at commondreams.org, dated July 30th. Are liberal Netroots groups helping Obama fail? Let me lift a quote. I fear that Netroots leaders are doing the same dance with Obama today that they did with Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid in 07-08. Instead of demanding the Democrats in Congress bring our troops home from Iraq by using the power of the purse to defund the war, Netroots leaders rallied behind weak, non-binding timelines and other halfway measures cooked up with congressional leaders. Well, Jeff, I've come up with a term for this. You recall that Ronald Reagan was famously referred to as the Teflon president?
Yep.
Well, I've coined a new term, Leflon. And Obama has the patent on it, and he's got an unlimited supply there in the White House. Because in his first 6 months in office, we haven't made a significant move to get out of Iraq. We have committed more troops to Afghanistan without any clear plan, without any public debate. And we've pushed trillions of dollars of taxpayer money and taxpayer liabilities out to the banks and financial institutions with we don't even have receipts for some
right.
of this stuff, for Christ's sake. And we see that on the left, people are saying, oh, we got Obama in there. I don't have to do anything.
Well, I get all of the email from every Netroots group. Every headline is, subject line, let's support Obama's this or that. You know, let's support Obama on this. Let's fight for Obama's that. And as I point out in my column, Obama is not one of us. He's a deal-making, compromising politician. And if you want Obama to be Obama, to be even, you know, barely liberal, you can't join Obama from the get-go in his kind of, compromise. You have to make demands on Obama so that he feels confident where he always wants to be, in the center, compromising, that he can point to the right wing and say, look, I got half of the country that wants Medicare for all. Or I got half of the country that wants me to start pulling out of Afghanistan. You know, but unless there's activists pushing for those maximum progressive reforms,
mm-hmm.
Obama will end up being a conservative president. He'll end up governing to the right of center. And he is governing to the right of center. And I blame liberal Netroots groups for not making maximum progressive demands that would allow Obama to get back in the center instead of continually drifting over to the right wing.
Jeff, I think your analysis is extremely cogent. And I think it's lost on too many people. And let's explore this for a moment. Why would people see Barack Obama? I mean, we've known for several years that he caved on single payer in Illinois. He uses the line that I first heard from Tom Daschle when I interviewed him and said, I'm for single payer. And I've used this line before where I say, I believe that the for-profit delivery of health care in this country has failed. It's a complete and utter failure. And we need
right.
to recognize that and address the right of every citizen to health care and find a way to implement that. And to me, it's single payer or Medicare for all. Those, you know, are the paths forward. So why would progressives negotiate with themselves and cave in so early when your points about Obama have been very clear all along? I mean, those of us who supported him from the left last year were not blind to the reality of who Barack Obama is.
Well, we were out to defeat McCain,
yeah,
the Republicans. I guess there's a certain seduction process that happens, where if you had a big group of liberals and you got a big email list, that the politicians start courting you, and you forget your roots, that you started out as an activist who was about a society for peace and justice, and before you know it, you're making your strategy with the politicians. That's not a recipe for success. If you make your policies, you make your strategy with the politicians, then you're going to begin your demand with what the politicians ask you to begin it with. So what we had during the 06, 07, 08 period, after the Democrats took Congress, is you had Pelosi's and the Reid's talking to the MoveOns and saying, well, we want to fight for a non-binding timeline on withdrawal of troops. Now, all the mainstream polls had showed that the reason the Democrats won so big in November 06 in congressional elections was because they were perceived as they were going to get us out of Iraq. And instead of activists who had contributed so much to the electoral success in the congressional elections in November 06, instead of them continuing to be activists, they became sort of complicit with the Democratic policymakers. And instead of making maximum demands, they start becoming co-conspirators or co-policymakers. And they lost track of what their role is. And in so doing, by becoming sort of inside the policy room from the beginning, instead of representing their millions of activists that want fundamental change in this country, then they end up, I think, undermining Obama and encouraging his worst instincts, which is to always cut a deal halfway toward the right wing. And if you know that's Obama's instinct, and we've known that, by the way, he hasn't changed in about 8 or 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
He always talks liberal to activist groups, but he governs conservatively. He did that even when he was in state government in Illinois, and he continued it when he was a senator. So we know who he is, and that's what's so stunning to me, that activist groups and Netroots groups feel that they've got to start sort of making the compromise before the debate begins. That's not how it works. That's not what the right wing does. You know, I look at the history of my country in the last 35 years, and I see the right wing winning and winning and winning at the federal policy level. And I would argue it's because the right-wing activist groups make demands, make maximum demands. If the Republicans don't adhere to those maximum demands, the activist leaders on the right wing threaten to get a new set of politicians, threaten to run against you in the Republican primary. It's because the right-wing activist leaders have been so hard-nosed that they've, I think, radically transformed our country for the worse,
mm-hmm.
but they've radically transformed it. And if we want to radically transform our country in a progressive direction, we can't have activist leaders that think they're politicians.
We also have a problem of two subbreeds of Dino, the Democrat in name only.
Yep.
We've got these people in the Senate, Ben Nelson, Mary Landrieu, Blanche Walmart Lincoln, who are a problem. In particular, because we do need at this point 59 votes for cloture.
But see, I don't think they're the problem. I think the problem is those people that are inside the White House, the Rahm Emanuels, the Hillary Clintons. Those are the problems. And Hillary Clinton was also on the board of Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's too easy to pick out the five or six Dixiecrats and pretend they're the problem. You know, the Republicans have never had 60 votes in the Senate. And it they never used that as an excuse, and the right-wing activist leaders never allowed the Republican leadership to use it as an excuse. Whether they had 60 votes or not, they have transformed our country for the worse.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hate it when our side says, well, we don't have the 60 votes. You don't need 60 votes. You never. All you needed was a bare majority to deny funding of the Iraq war, and you could have brought our troops home. You know, the Democratic leaders are great at coming up with excuse, and one of the problems is liberal activist leaders conspire with them to help give them excuses.
Now, I hear what you're saying, but I also believe that there's a failure to impose some party discipline, because
yep.
I think that Obama should have a heart-to-heart talk with those wobbly senators and say,
yep.
look, you owe me a vote on cloture. If you want to remain a Democrat, then when I call for it, and particularly on this health insurance reform that I'm trying to get through here, Ben Nelson, if I call for your vote on cloture, you better be there. You can then vote against the bill if that is your
yep.
opinion.
Yep.
But number one, I need to demand that you honor my call on cloture votes. And the second piece of it is over in the House, Jeff, where Nancy Pelosi has really sown the seeds for her own failure here. Because in order to become Speaker, she recruited. She was on the road actively recruiting these self-funded people. Half of the freshman class of 06 pledged Blue Dog immediately.
Yep.
And these are the people, and it's really just a handful, who are the obstructionists on the House side.
And don't exempt Rahm Emanuel, who was the head of the Congressional Committee during
right.
the period you're describing.
Sure.
That he and Pelosi were going around, but especially Emanuel. And they were finding, as you say, the self-funded businessmen, the people who were so vague on Iraq, you didn't know what the hell they stood for. And the Rahm Emanuels went out there and tried to defeat progressives within the Democratic primary.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess my concern is we know who Rahm Emanuel is. We know who Hillary Clinton is. We know, you know, I come from a state of New York, which is supposed to be a progressive state, and the Democratic governor just chose a Blue Dog Democrat from the state of New York, a congresswoman, to become our senator.
Yeah, Gillibrand.
Replacing Hillary. So
mm-hmm.
we've gone from Hillary Clinton to someone even worse than Hillary Clinton. So I guess I'm saying that we have powerful liberal activists. If you talk to people at any event, all these MoveOn members that I've met over the years, all these Democracy for America members and former Howard Dean supporters from 2004, on issues, they're seriously progressive. But I would argue not only are they misled and, you know, of lousy leadership from the Hillary Clintons and the Schumers and the Gillibrands and the Obamas, but they're not getting good leadership from the leaders of the grassroots organizations. And what we need to do is, like you point out, who gets elected to some of these congressional seats as Democrats. That's because instead of these liberal netroots groups going after Democrats who extended the Iraq war or Democrats today who continue to shill for the insurance industry, and going after them in primaries and letting them know you're going to go after them.
Mm-hmm.
There's all these emails I get, let's defend Obama's this. And then a week later, let's defend Obama on that. I mean, I'm tired of defending Obama, and I would argue that that's not how the right wing built a powerful movement. They didn't do it by rallying around a compromising Republican.
Mm-hmm.
They shed compromising Republicans, and they rallied around extreme right-wing Republicans and put those people in a continuously more powerful position within the party.
Yeah.
That's what liberal netroots people need to do if they really care about issues of peace and justice and environmental sustainability. It's a constant churning, where if you elect someone as a Democrat and then they end up representing the insurance industry, you make their lives miserable in the next election. And there's just not enough of that. There's too much rallying around Obama and not enough Well, let's create a political party that really stands for issues of peace and justice, and let's replace these people that you're calling the dinos, Democrats in name only, and get real Democrats in.
Mm-hmm.
And you start that at the town level, the city level, the county level, and then you work your way up to state and national politics. I think it's what progressive Democrats of America are trying to do, but they're a relatively small group, especially on the internet, mm-hmm. and they're getting very little help from the bigger Netroots groups that should be about that mission.
Yeah. Jeff Cohen, if you could put back your media criticism hat, I just wanted to close by describing a rather bizarre exchange that I saw on CNN just the other night. And Anderson Cooper, who every time I look at him, I think he doesn't have the fear of God in him. He's got the fear of Fox in him.
Yeah.
And before he introduced a segment called Getting It Right, where he asked Dr. Sanjay Gupta to comment on the so-called death panels, he first intoned, and this was opinion masquerading as anchor reporting. He said that, much of the town hall anger is real. He just stipulated that.
Yep.
And then he went to Sanjay Gupta, and, they put the graphic up, we're getting it right. And Gupta, the strongest term that he could come up for these false allegations of death panels in the Johnny Isaacson part of the bill,
yep.
is the word hyperbole. Now,
yep.
it is sheer falsehood. It is
yep.
demagoguery. It is
yep.
a lie. And on CNN, they were afraid to offend some of the viewers that they think they share with the Fox News channel. And that's why you heard Cooper say, oh, yeah, some of this anger is real. And then you heard Gupta choosing his words very carefully, because he basically said it's not true, but he could not bring himself to say it is a lie that is being promoted by certain interests who would benefit from blocking any reform.
Well, they don't. Look, there's been a process that's happened in the media and in the political system for years, which is you pander to the lie. You go half the way over with crazy. If the whole world is, if you have all these power groups and Fox News and telling you that there's weapons of mass destruction, then there goes the Washington Post editorial page half the way to crazy
mm-hmm.
with the right wing. There goes the front page of the New York Times half the way to crazy. CNN looks over there at Fox News. Anderson Cooper gets beat almost night after night by Fox News. And they look over and say, wow, they've got a big audience. Let's pander half the way to crazy. Now, journalists are supposed to try to ferret out the truth, separate fact from fiction. It's what the ethics say that we journalists are supposed to do. But, the TV networks function more as political institutions. So if there's huge myths that are in the realm, then you begin your discussion with the myth
mm-hmm.
and say, well, is the myth completely right? And so this idea of a CNN journalist being about separating fact and fiction, I don't think that's been the case since a few years after Ted Turner started the place.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's what's happening in mainstream media as a whole. That's the beauty of a show like yours and podcasts and the independent media that basically will say this is a lie. Here's what the fact is. There is objective truth in the world.
Mm-hmm.
This is what reality is, and this is what these politicians, whether Democrat or Republican, whether liberal or conservative, here's how they're distorting reality. That just doesn't happen much in the mainstream media, especially TV networks, where they function more as sort of political operations rather than as journalistic operations.
I think we have the title for your next book.
Yeah.
Halfway to Crazy.
That's what we say when someone goes on, like, the O'Reilly Show or
uh-huh.
some of these shows and tries to, like, rein him in. They
yeah.
think, well, I'm sort of reining him in. I mean, I used to go on O'Reilly Show, but he wasn't nutty. I was on his show about 10 times when I was on the payroll of Fox News. But sometimes I'll watch, like, a professor go on there.
Mm-hmm.
And, the professor's listening to O'Reilly completely distort what the professor writes. Well, that's not exactly what I had in mind. And, the segment ends, and you realize, God, they've gone half the way to crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty, it's something.
All right, Jeff, I'm going to leave it there and let people just work that phrase over a little bit.
Yeah, it's what our society's become.
Great.
It's what Obama does. Let's go half the way with crazy. You know, let's go half the way with Grassley, who's talking about death panels.
Mm-hmm.
All right, thanks, Peter.
Jeff Cohen, is there a website where you proliferate?
Yeah, the best place is just jeffcohen.org.
jeffcohen.org. All right, sir. Great to talk to you again. Thanks for your activism. Don't stop.
All right. Bye-bye.
Jeff Cohen on the Peter B. Collins Show. A little musical break here on the Peter B. Collins Show as we continue our discussion about health care reform. And that's in air quotes. It's just health insurance reform, really. And if you've got coverage, this song's for you.
Someone's drinking corn champagne in another part of town.
It's ex-Eagle Glenn Frey.
The only thing he thinks about as he sips his glass of wine. She feels good sitting here tonight. Now that I've got mine, I've got mine.
Yeah, when I see these yahoos at the town hall meetings, you know, they've all got health insurance. And many of them are on Medicare, even though they decry socialist delivery of health care. I think what we need are some angry medical doctors to enter this debate and help put it on the right track. Let's talk to Dr. Gene Uphoff. He's a medical doctor in Portland, Oregon. He practices at the Portland Family Practice. That sounds like one of these big commercial HMOs. Dr. Uphoff, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Now, Portland Family Practice, is this connected to HCA or Kaiser or one of these big behemoths?
No, it's not, actually. I started the practice about 28 years ago as a solo practitioner, and during the last 28 years, we've gradually grown and added more like-minded physicians to our group. We are now up to 11,
mm-hmm.
and we are independent of any of the hospital or insurance plans other than, as most doctors have to, we need to contract with some of these health plans in order to have patients allowed to see us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you and a couple of other doctors are going to hit the road after Labor Day and make your case across the country as you head to Washington, D.C. And the information is available on the web at madashelldoctors.com. And I guess this comes out of the movie Network, and I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. But tell us what your thought is about the way this whole process has gone to date. And what you'd like to do to shake it up and put it on a different track?
It's been amazing to me to watch this unfold, and it's actually happened faster than I think any of us would have appreciated when it first began. There's been a long sense in the medical profession that there are serious problems with their healthcare system. It's clearly broken. We don't really have good answers available to us in the current system the way it's set up. You know, psychiatrists sometimes make this joke that insanity, the definition of it, is that you keep repeating the same behavior over and over again and somehow expecting a different result, that the outcome will be different. And that's kind of what's happened in healthcare, that we keep saying, well, if we have more insurance coverage, more policies in place, more people who are enrolled or throwing more money after it, somehow it's going to get better.
Mm-hmm. And tell me from your perspective, you know, we've heard all of this demagoguery about end-of-life, death panels, and tell me what your experience is today with the insurance companies calling the shots. We hear about death panels, which are completely fictional, but we have what I call death squads, which are insurance companies that make profits. They make bigger profits the more often they deny care. And because the end-of-life portion is where people have the greatest demand and the biggest cost of health care in their life cycle, that is logically where they do the most denial of care.
That's absolutely right. And there are many, many ways in which this comes to the fore. But the problem we've had as physicians is that we don't get the opportunity to try to head off some of those end-of-life problems. You know, in the United States, most Americans, if you look at the average, they make about 4 visits a year to see a doctor. If you look at other countries where they have universal health care, there is much less obstruction to getting into the medical care system. France, for example, which is rated number 1 in the world in terms of their health outcomes, has an average of about 10 visits per year per person to the doctor. We're only at about 4, and we're ranked 37th in the world in most health measures.
Also, the life expectancy in France is 3 years greater than the United States, 81 versus 78.
Yep.
And they have more doctors per 10,000 population, 34 as compared to 26.
Yep.
And they spend about half as much, $3,400 per head per year. And we're spending $6,700, and that's going up at double-digit rates every year.
Exactly right.
Now, why is it that we're able to demonize the French systems and other so-called socialized healthcare delivery modes when they're more efficient, more effective, and the outcomes are better? They're just these anecdotal stories that drive the opposition.
That's true, and I think it's distressing to me because, you know, at least in medicine, we get to read literature from studies that are published all over the world. You know, we look at something like prostate cancer, which worries a huge number of Americans. And yet, if you look at the studies that have looked at diagnosis and treatment of prostate cancer, those are published in Austria, they're published in France, in Germany, Switzerland. They're not all just American studies. And the result is that medicine has a much more sense of international community, really, than the United States government does.
Dr. Epoff, I take the radical position that the for-profit delivery of health care in this country is a failure, that we need to accept that, and that we can't have realistic reform that will cover the bulk, if not all, of the population and reduce costs as we head into the future without a single-payer system. Would you agree or disagree?
I completely agree. You know, about 2 weeks ago, our business section in the paper here in Portland reported that the federal government has just gone through an extensive analysis of the economy over the last 60 years, back to 1947. And they found some interesting things out, one of which was that the highs were higher and the lows were lower than had previously been reported. But the other thing that they decided to do was to segregate out health expenditures. And the way they did this is they said any money that goes into the health system that isn't actually spent on the delivery of a service, a surgery, a doctor's office visit, a prescription or something, they would take that out as administrative. And the result was that they said we're not really spending 18.5% of gross domestic product on our health services. We're actually only spending 16%, which, of course, is still dramatically higher than other countries spend. And that, in fact, pointed out that we're spending 2.5% of gross domestic product then goes into administration. This is what the health insurance company use for competition, for marketing, for claims review and claims denial, of course, as well as shareholder profits and the enormous CEO salaries. CEO salaries in the private industry run around $14 million a year average, and that doesn't count the millions and millions of stock options. So if you look at that, 2.5% of gross domestic product, we're talking about somewhere in the neighborhood of $600 billion a year. And that's way, way more than previous estimates, which usually pegged at around $400 billion a year that was going into administration. If you look at the health care plan, they're spending roughly 30%, about $3 out of every 10 on profit, administration, salaries, and so forth, whereas Medicare gets by on about 30 cents.
Well, and since we started talking a few minutes ago, they've spent about $1 million on propaganda and pushing lies out into the media, and the media is complicit and willing to accept all this because, they like to see conflict and dispute, even if it's completely irrational.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, that's what makes news. And news in the United States right now sort of is a entertainment industry for a lot of people.
Well, that's a sad commentary, but it's true. Now, tell me about your plans. If people go to MattisHealthDoctors.com, There is a route map that they can see. And you're going to be leaving from Portland on September the 8th, is that right?
That's correct. September the 8th, we are hoping to have a huge send-off. We're working on developing the details right now, but we want a big send-off downtown. And we will head up north to Seattle. We have our first outside of Portland event then on the 8th in the evening in Seattle. And from there, we go on to Spokane. And we're expecting to stop in Helena, Montana, Idaho Falls, Salt Lake City, Fort Collins, Denver, Des Moines, Iowa, St. Paul, Minneapolis.
Now, wait a minute. What about Nebraska? You're going all the way through Nebraska?
You're
not going to stop?
Now, the sad fact was that we had requests from individuals and organizations in about 35 cities. And there's just no way we could do it. And we tried to combine both how much on-the-ground organization there was in a particular location, along with how many miles it was between one city and the next to decide what we could do. And we did, I have to say, we did put a couple of rest days in there, because going from city to city to city and doing something every single night seemed more grueling than us physicians were used to.
Well, and I see you're going to stop in Iowa, where you can talk to Chuck Grassley's friends and let them know that he's been, for some reason, just fulminating things that simply aren't true.
Yeah, it's sad. I think that it's hard for us to know on the outside looking in how much of this commotion that's being stirred up at town hall meetings and so on is a result of people simply being afraid of what's happening and not understanding the proposals that are out there, and how much of it comes because they're being sort of fomented into action by people who want to take advantage.
Well, your even-handedness there, I appreciate, Doctor, because it's true that I think the Democrats have fumbled by allowing us to go into this August fight period without explicit proposals on the table.
Exactly.
And we don't know what the public option is, and I'm very leery of that. I don't think it's going to address the critical issues of covering more people and bringing costs under control long-term. And so the Democrats have served up this very amorphous target that the Republicans are tagging things onto, and they don't have to be true. You know, the bizarre notion that these death panels were going to be created comes out of legislation from a conservative Republican from Georgia, for God's sake.
Exactly.
And yet they're very willing to turn that into a target that confuses people, that's used as a projection for this phony anger. And as Rachel Maddow has done a great job of detailing on her program in the evening, this is not just coming from grassroots. This is heavily funded by think tanks, by law firms, by these PR groups that are out there with these AstroTurf organizations. And I get the emails. The Christian Coalition is sounding the alarm about government control of health care. And, you know, I just find this bizarre that all of this stuff is sticking, but the Democrats created a big fat target, and that's why some of this stuff will stick.
I think you're absolutely right. You know, a psychologist friend of mine said something probably 15, 20 years ago that has stuck in my brain, I think is exactly right on, and that is that rumors do not start because of something people say. Rumors start because of something people want to hear. And if someone hears something that kind of fits with their pre-existing notions or their biases, they will pass it on. They will say, oh, yeah, that's right, and they'll pass it on to as many people as possible.
Well, the other part of this is that, at least tracing it to its recent core, Sarah Palin has celebrated stupid. And she just recites a series of attack lines that people clap for, but there's no meat there. There's no substance. And she doesn't have a better plan of her own. She's just a sniper. But this is the kind of, it's what's passing for political dialogue and what's being boiled down to a so-called debate over these issues right now, even though the Obama administration has narrowed this to health insurance reform. They're not talking about any fundamental changes here. We are shuffling the deck of who gets profit from covering whom in the, you know, the current system.
Well, exactly right. And in fact, the ironic part of all of this is that Sarah Palin, a year and a half ago, was advocating for having physicians discuss end-of-life choices with their parents. You know, she just, it just, it's amazing how she could forget that she was doing this just a year ago.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that I think has been missing is the voice of doctors. And I'm glad that you and your colleagues are making this road trip, and I hope you get a lot of media attention. Because I've seen some activist nurses, and there is a Dr. Flowers who got arrested a couple of times, demanding that Max Baucus hear the single-payer advocates. But by and large, the medical profession seems to be on the sidelines in this struggle.
I think that has been true. Certainly, that's the if you look at the Physicians for National Health program, they've been around for almost 20 years now, and there's 18,000 physician members who, in fact, do advocate for it. But, you know, physicians are a fairly cautious and conservative group, and they have tended to not want to sully their image by sounding like they're too loud or too raucous. And the result has been that even though I think we have a pretty good handle on what the problems in the healthcare industry really amount to, we haven't been particularly active. And as we've started to see the ways in which the health system has been deteriorating, it has goaded some of us into more aggressive action. And we had a lot of discussion when we were forming this group as to whether the term Mattis Health Doctors was maybe a little bit too pushy, a little bit too out there. And after talking with other people who said, God, that's a great name. Thank God you're finally doing something. We thought, you know, that's really the way to say it because we are mad about it. It's crazy. This insanity has gone on far too long. It's been 60 years that the health insurance industry has tried to figure out how to deliver health care to everybody, and it's been a total failure.
Well, we're going to have to send you to some kind of an anger camp, though, because you really seem to have it under control, Doc, and I was expecting somebody who's rabid, who's foaming at the mouth, who I could recommend anger management training to. But it's like you need the flip of that. You need to access the real pissed off inner core.
You know, I had an interesting thing happen a few years ago. If you remember back in 2005, when Congress flew back to Washington, I think it was March 20th, and they got together and they passed this law that would require the doctors to reinsert a feeding tube into Terri Schiavo.
Yeah.
Terri Schiavo was this poor woman who had spent 15 years in a coma, was brain dead in a constant vegetative state. And there'd been a huge 4 or 5 years of legal wrangling back and forth to allow her life support to be discontinued. So what happened was the courts finally said that, yes, the feeding tube could be withdrawn. Congress, in its response, flew back, passed this resolution to reinsert the feeding tube, and President Bush flew back from his ranch to sign it at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
On a Sunday.
Yeah.
And 2 days later, one of my elderly patients came in to see me. Very nice guy. I've known him for a long time. I really love him and his family. But he was all aglow, and he said, wasn't that just wonderful, what our president and Congress tried to do last weekend to save the life of that poor woman in Florida? And I just shook my head, and I thought, what are you thinking? You know, I said, you know, if they really cared about the health of Americans, they would have flown back to Washington last weekend not to pass this crazy recommendation that the feeding tube be reinserted, but to pass single-payer health care reform, because there were 18,000 people who died last year because they didn't have health care coverage.
Yeah.
And if they really cared about it, that's what they would have done instead of doing this grandstand act.
And, Doctor, finally, I see this as a proxy class struggle. And I opened our segment here with that Glenn Frey song, I've Got Mine.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm seeing in this is that the people who currently have care, even though the standard of employer-provided health care coverage has badly eroded, and only about half the working population now enjoys that, and even still, they're paying higher copays. Some of them have to pay part of the premium now. And it's as if people don't see that they are frogs in boiling water, and that we really are in the same pot, but they happen to have coverage today, and they seem to think that if they beat back this effort to share the wealth, that they will be protected in the future. And I think it's a crock. I think
it's
that
kind
they're
of delusional.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is sad. You know, if you look at the last 10 years, the average wage in America has gone up about 29%, and at the same time, the overall rise in the cost of living—if you look at inflation—it's gone up 44%. So yes, we are worse off than we were. But if you then look at health insurance, the average out-of-pocket expense, how much we've had to pay, has gone up 115%, and the average cost of premiums has gone up 120%. So health insurance premiums, assuming that you have them and that your employer is willing to pay them, have risen at 4 times the rate of incomes. And that's just insane.
Yeah.
That's not sustainable. And the result is that those of us who are involved in the Mad as Hell Doctors Tour, we just think that it's time to become more adamant. And yeah, we will be louder, and we will be trying to make our case, not only in the rallies as we cross the country, but when we arrive in Washington, to sort of beat down the doors of Congress and say, okay, enough of this messing around. Let's do it.
Now, for our listeners across the country, I'm going to briefly mention all of the stops on the Mad as Hell Doctors tour. And if you go to madashelldoctors.com, you can get the details on when and a specific location in your area. Portland, Seattle, Spokane, Helena, Idaho Falls, Salt Lake, Fort Collins, Denver, Des Moines, St. Paul, Madison, Fort Wayne, Chicago, Indianapolis, Louisville, Nashville, Dayton, Toledo, Cleveland, Detroit, Pittsburgh, and arriving in Washington, D.C. about the end of September. Again, madashelldoctors.com. Our thanks to Dr. Gene Uphoff from Portland. And happy trails, Doctor.
Thank you, thank you.
All right. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. I want to hear your comments.
Happy trails to you.
Log on to peterbcollins.com. Drop a comment right below this podcast if you like. And email me personal, Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Keep smiling.